All right, let's take our Bibles and turn to the book of Zechariah. It's interesting to hear different words used in these Baptist history segments, and reminded of, okay, the congregational church. Who is the congregational church? And I don't know, could be slightly an error here, but congregational church is the Church of England, but they have a different form of government. And in the Church of England, there were a few different thoughts, but one was considered a high church view, and that kind of viewed that the bishop or the episcopus or whatever was the powerful one, and he spoke and did what the church did what he decided. And that would be more of what we'd see down in Virginia, things like that. I think it was last week Mr. Brady was talking about the governor of Virginia, I think it was there, maybe it was somewhere else. Anyway, but very, very powerful authority in one person. And then another part of the Episcopal or Anglican Church believed in had a low church view, and that was that the power came from the lower part of the church, the people. Okay, so you'd have a congregational church, still an Episcopal church, still an Anglican church, still they believe very strongly that you must baptize your children, still would persecute Baptists, but in a certain sense a little better view of church government than the high church view. It's just kind of interesting. I was doing some reading recently about our American history, and so that when he said congregational, I thought, oh, that's what that congregational would be the low church view of the Anglican tradition, and the I don't know what they'd call the powerful bishop view, but that's the high church view. Anyway, Zechariah, we've been looking at Zechariah now for 2 weeks, and we have two more weeks counting today. We're 14 chapters in the book, and so although we're taking 4 weeks to look at it, we're really moving very quickly. Not as quickly as we've gone through the other minor prophets. You know, somebody, Billy Hardecker, has been looking at some of my things. We put it on sermon audio. He's listening to it, and he said, my sprint. I was saying it's a fast survey or a run, and he's calling it a sprint. Well, if that's what it is, we've gotten to Zechariah, and we kind of got a side stitch, and we're slowing down just a little bit as we get to the finish line. So we're going to look at chapters 9 through 11 this morning of Zechariah. Next week, chapters 12 through 14. And then the next week, September 1st, the book of Malachi, which is really just 3 chapters and 6 verses or something like 6 verses, I think, in the 4th chapter of Malachi. But in Zechariah, we have what some have called the most prophetic and the most messianic of the minor prophets. And Zechariah prophesies in the time, if you look on the chart that we've got there, we've been here, so I haven't reviewed this each week, but he prophesies in the time after the children of Israel have returned from their exile into Babylon. Now, not all of them returned from Babylon, but I believe somewhere around 50,000 went back with Zerubbabel and Ezra back in those portions of the Bible, we see that. So there's a good number of people in Jerusalem. 50,000 is a good number, but nothing like the tremendous number that were there when they were taken captive and slaughtered, and nothing like the number that was there 400 years later when they were destroyed, or 400 or 500 years later when they were destroyed by the Romans. But when we looked at, getting it right here, Haggai, the people had come back. And we remember from reading in Ezra and Nehemiah how the people around them didn't like the fact that the Israelites had come back to their land. And now they had been given permission to build the temple. A little while later, when Nehemiah came, they were given permission to build the wall of Jerusalem. They'd been given this permission by the Persian rulers, but the people around didn't like that. And so they sent back word, and there was these diplomatic, we might say, political battles going on. And so the surrounding people sent back word, and so some ruler sent word saying not to do something. And I'm pretty sure they were not to just expand their city, but he did not prohibit them from building the temple. But the people took that as an excuse. Remember, in Haggai, he says, you say, now is not the time to build the temple, presumably because of all the problems around them, but you live in houses that are tiled and sealed, and your houses are fancy. There's plenty of time to build your house, but you don't have any time to build the temple. And he says, consider your ways. That's a key phrase in the book of Haggai. Consider your ways. Look at how it's all worked out for you when you haven't put me in the place that I should have in your life. Haggai challenges them several sermons there, and we kind of see the actions, the sermons and the reactions and the people, and we see that in Haggai. In Zechariah started prophesying, I think we said, just 2 months after Haggai. So they were contemporaries in the same city. Sure, they knew each other. But Zechariah's prophecy seemed to be more, might we say, doctrinal, more up in the sky. It is practical, and there are some certain things in here that we can say he brings it home to them, but there's more prophecies involved and that, and so it is a little different view coming from a different man to the same people at the same time. We have 14 chapters in Zechariah, and the first six are basically one vision that he had in the nighttime. At the beginning of the book, he introduces himself sort of to us as we read it, and he calls the people to repentance. And then it says 2 months later, basically in the night, he had this vision. And in that vision, he had eight visions, eight parts to this night vision. And it seems that all of those visions were to encourage the people of Israel. Again, they had come back to the land. They were supposed to be building the temple. They had stopped and quit. Haggai preaches to them, and they start up again. But they look around, and there's not much there. They look at the foundations of the temple that they had laid, and it was nothing. They could tell just by looking at the foundations that it was going to be nothing like the temple that those that were old among them had seen when they were young. There was much to be discouraged by. The people on the outside were discouraged, were against them, antagonizing them. They might think, even if we do build a temple, will we even be able to worship in it? Or will we always be fighting for our lives? Will they take us over and destroy us? So Zechariah's first prophecy, this vision that he has with eight parts to it, is encouraging the people of Israel that God is with them, and that he is going to bring them to prosperity. So, and I'm just going to review this. The first one is he sees the man among the myrtle trees. You might flip through. You might not see it as I've got it listed here. The man among the myrtle trees. And if you remember, the man among the myrtle trees is the angel of Jehovah, the pre-incarnate. And when we use that word, pre-incarnate, when Christ came as a baby, that is called his incarnation. And sometimes I use words that I'm used to using in college classes, and I have to stop and think, do you know what I mean when I say that? The pre-incarnate. The incarnation is when Christ came as a baby and lived as a man in human flesh that we could see. Pre-incarnation is times before that we believe Christ was here on the earth. The pre-incarnate Christ, if you see the angel of the Lord, the angel of Jehovah, is the pre-incarnate Christ. And there's a couple other places where we believe it was him. One is when the three men came to talk with Abraham before they went to destroy the city of Sodom and Gomorrah. One of those is God, and then the two other angels left and performed the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. But, so, the angel of Jehovah, the angel of the Lord, is the man among the myrtle trees. And so that's the pre-incarnate Christ in this vision, in this night vision. And the idea given there, and it even says there, that God promises prosperity to the people of Israel. Now that has to be tremendously encouraging. You're sitting there, you don't have walls around your city, you have just the foundation, and you don't have, you have hardly any means or anything, but God comes and says, I will prosper the people of Israel. I will prosper you. I will be with you. Then, the next vision is a vision of four horns and four carpenters. The four horns are symbols of power that drove out or judged, that God used to judge the people of Israel. And the four carpenters are those that God used to come behind those four horns and judge them for being too harsh in their judgment, if we would put it that way. God judges the nations that attack Israel, is what we would understand from the four horns and four carpenters. And then he sees a man with a measuring line. And this measuring line, he's measuring the city of Jerusalem. And what does that mean? The Bible tells us that God is the one that will rebuild Jerusalem. They do their work, but God is going to rebuild Jerusalem. And he's measured it out, and he's going to build the city of Jerusalem. I believe that's where he says he's going to. There will come a day when there'll be so many people in Jerusalem that the walls won't be able to contain them. They're going to spread beyond the walls. But the fire of God will be a wall to protect his people. God rebuilds Jerusalem. Then there's the cleansing of the high priest. He sees a vision of an adversary, Satan, next to the high priest, accusing. And the high priest is full of filthy garments, just like we are full of filthy garments. But God cleanses those, takes those garments away, and clothes him. And so it's showing that God would purify his people and his high priest. Then there's the vision of the golden candlestick and the two olive trees. The golden candlestick is something that would be in the temple, and the two olive trees shows that candlestick. We see there that the candlestick would be always fed by oil from the olive trees. Rather than a priest having to come along and refill the oil, these trees would be there, and there was pipes, if you want to call it that, that fed the golden candlestick. And this showed, you say, how do we know this showed? We don't have time to go back through it. Through all of these, the angel says, what do you see? He says, I see this. And then he says, what does it mean? And sometimes he says, you don't know what it means. Or sometimes he just tells them what it means. And this shows that God would rebuild his temple. You remember the phrase, not by might, not by power, but by my spirit. That phrase comes right from this part of the vision, the golden candlestick and the two olive trees. Then the flying roll, or it would be better thought of as a scroll. It's not a flying carpet. It's not a flying biscuit. It's a flying scroll. It has writing on one side and on the other side. Representatively, we see the third commandment on the one side, which is the middle of the first five, and the eighth commandment on the other side, which is the middle of the second five. And this showed that God would remove sin and idolatry from his people in Jerusalem. Then the seventh vision was the vision of the woman in the ephah, or in the basket. An ephah is similar to a bushel. Not exactly the same amount, but similar to a bushel. And so this woman is in the basket and has a large, very heavy lead weight on top, holding it down. You lift the lead weight up, and there is wickedness, it says. And they slam the lid back down on it, and these two beings come and lift it up and carry it off to Babylon. That's the picture of the religious system, false religious system that would be taken away from Jerusalem and planted in Babylon, the land of Shinar. The eighth vision is a vision of four chariots. Two go to the north, one goes to the south, one goes to and fro, and these chariots satisfy the wrath, I think it is, of God. He calms his spirit. His spirit is agitated against the north, against the south, because they have attacked Israel. But his work, these four spirits, four chariots, bring peace and rest to Israel. Finally, then, at the end of the sixth chapter, we see this sign. The men come from Babylon, and he says, take their offering of gold and silver and turn it into crowns, and place those crowns on the head of the priest, which is not something that would happen in Old Testament Israel, but it was a sign that the priest would be crowned with crowns, that both rulership and priesthood would come together in one, and that's a prophecy, a sign of the Messiah, who will be both king and priest. Then we come to chapter 7 and 8, where there's these four messages. some men came and asked, should we continue to fast? We fast in the fifth month, and by the time we get to the end of chapter 8, we see they fasted in the fourth month, the fifth month, the seventh month, and the tenth month, and all of those fasts had to do with the destruction of Israel or the captivity of the people of Israel. Said, should we fast? Because the temple is being rebuilt, and we are back in the land, and basically the answer is hardly given. First, he basically says, when you fasted, did you fast to yourself? Or did you fast to me? Or was it just a fast? When you feasted, when you ate, didn't you eat just for yourself? All these things that you were doing were just for yourself. They weren't unto me. You had the wrong motives. What really needs to be is repentance. And then in chapter 8, he talks about how he would restore favor upon the city of Jerusalem and the people of Israel, and then that those fasts that they had would become feasts of celebration because of all that God had done. So then we come to chapters 9 through 14, where there's two final prophecies, we'd call. They're called the burden of the word of Jehovah. We see that in the very beginning of chapter 9, and we'll see that again in chapter 12. So there's these two burdens or prophecies. And we'll begin reading the text, and basically I'm going to read and give short comment along the way. My goal is that the little comments I say, maybe one or two of them, maybe that's a low goal, maybe all of them, will stick in your mind the next time you read through Zechariah, and it will help you understand it. And the better you can understand what the text says, the better the Holy Spirit can use it to teach you something from it. I will try to teach one or two little things along the way, but I'm going to try to help you understand what the text says as we go through this sprint through the minor prophets. And as I read it, there's a visible difference, and you that have been here all summer could probably quote this for me, but there's different people here every week. There's a visible difference when we read the scriptures between Lord and Lord. You can see that as you read. There's capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D. And then there's other places where it's just capital L and then O-R-D. Those are two different meanings. There's two different meanings behind those words. And since I'm speaking audibly and you can't hear the difference, I'm going to replace the all capital Lord with the word that's behind it, which we understand and know is God's personal name, Jehovah. So as I read through, you're going to hear me say Jehovah, and that's just so that we can hear the difference between when it says Lord and when he's referring to their God. Our God, Jehovah, is Lord. He is the Lord. He's the Lord of all other lords. He's the King of all kings. But he has a name, and his name is Jehovah. And so I'm not trying to get a movement going or anything like that, but just when I'm reading quickly, rather than do all this explanation each time, I'm explaining now, and I'm not going to explain it further as we go through. There are visitors each week. I mention it each week so they don't come up to me and say, are you reading from the King James Version? Yes, I am. But I've done that, and I've taken the ths out because they're easier for me to read as s's, and that they mean exactly the same thing as I've studied. Dr. Waite, D.A. Waite talks about ways to understand clearly and more quickly some of those old words. Somebody has asked about that. Hath is the same word as has. So, and it's easier. I have to do a lot of reading, and the more I explain, I'm going to have to read even faster. But that's some of why those things, I'm not changing the text at all. In fact, it's very similar to the difference. If we put in front of you a 1611 King James Version, there would be a big, looks like an F, and it's actually an S. So there's just addition type adjustments. So in this first burden, we got through that explanation. In the first burden, there are going to be two burdens. The first burden talks about the Messiah's first advent, Jesus Christ's first coming to the earth, and its prophecy. I will say this, as I was studying, I was thinking, well, this is not as clear as all the rest has been. And if you've heard preachers say, it's easy to understand what the Bible says. I'll admit there's some places where it's not the easiest. I think this is one of those places where it's not the easiest. But when prophets prophesied, it seems clear that sometimes if you've ever looked at a mountain range, you see a bunch of mountains. Once you get into the mountain range, you see that there's a valley between some of those mountains. It didn't look like it. It just looked like a beautiful mountain range. But you start hiking in there, and you see a big mountain, and you get behind it, and there's more mountains. It's not two-dimensional, it's three-dimensional. And so prophecies, especially toward the future, are not two-dimensional. We'll see something in one phrase we can see is obviously fulfilled, and the very next phrase is not fulfilled. And so that would be, we can see the first one is in his first advent, and the second phrase is still yet future. Doesn't mean that he doesn't keep his promises, that prophecies will not be fulfilled. In fact, I believe it's strong evidence that prophecies will be fulfilled because the first part is fulfilled. We could see that it was fulfilled. So we know that the next part will also be fulfilled. So when I say it's about his first advent, I've got a little plus sign next to that in my notes. It's first advent plus because it's mostly first advent, but there's some things in there that were kind of fulfilled, but will be more fully fulfilled yet in the future. And then we see prophecy of his rejection. And that is, of course, when he was crucified. So, chapter 9. The burden of the word of Jehovah in the land of Hadrach and Damascus shall be the rest thereof. When the eyes of man, as of all the tribes of Israel, shall be toward Jehovah, and Hamath also shall border thereby, Tyrus and Zidon, though it be very wise. And Tyrus did build herself a stronghold, and heaped up silver as the dust, and fine gold as the mire of the streets. Behold, the Lord will cast her out, and he will smite her power in the sea. And Tyre did this. Tyre had a city on the coast. It was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar. They built a city out in the middle of the sea, an island, and they had 150-foot walls around there, almost could not get to it. Alexander the Great comes along, pushes all the rubble that Nebuchadnezzar destroyed into the sea. And all of a sudden, there's a nice road straight up to the city of Tyrus. They thought they were impregnable. They thought they were wise. They built themselves a stronghold in the sea. And Alexander comes along and just pushes the rubble out there, builds a causeway, and marches his soldiers right on dry land to Tyre and destroys them. So that's where we see some fulfillment of this. They did build herself a stronghold, heaped up silver as the dust, fine gold as the mire of the streets. Behold, the Lord will cast her out, and he will smite her power in the sea. She shall be devoured with fire. Ashkelon, now these are cities of the Philistines, shall see it and fear. Gaza or Gaza also shall see it and be very sorrowful. And Ekron, for her expectation shall be ashamed, and the king shall perish from Gaza, and Ashkelon shall not be inhabited. So the cities of the Philistines will be destroyed, okay? And this happened. Alexander came down the coast of that area. Tyre and Zidon is north of Israel. Philistia, those cities are kind of south of Israel, but he bypassed Israel. In history, we see he bypassed Israel. He destroyed them. It says, and a bastard shall dwell in Ashdod, and I will cut off the pride of the Philistines, and I will take away his blood out of his mouth and his abominations from between his teeth. But he that remains, even he, shall be for our God. And he shall be as a governor in Judah, and Ekron as a Jebusite. And I will encamp about my house because of the army, because of him that passes by, and because of him that returns. He passed by, went down to Egypt, subdued them, and returned and came back, and yet did not destroy the city of Jerusalem. And because of him, and no oppressor shall pass through them anymore, for now have I seen with my eyes. Now that phrase, no oppressor shall pass through them anymore, did not, this was partially fulfilled with Alexander. Alexander did not pass through Jerusalem, but since then, several kingdoms have. But there will be a day, yet future, where no oppressor will pass through them anymore. Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, thy king comes unto thee. He is just and having salvation. This we see. It's very clear. This is the quote, triumphal entry of Jesus Christ. It's having salvation gives the idea that this salvation is not that he has it with him. He has it in him. He has salvation in himself. He provides salvation in himself. He is just and having salvation. He is just and the justifier of him that believeth in Jesus. Okay, we have justice and mercy right in the same person, in the king that comes. And he's lowly. As I was thinking about this and reading some stuff, someone pointed out that no other Messiah, and the Jews have believed in many Messiahs. They haven't believed in the Messiah. They've had many that they claim might have been a Messiah. No Messiah, no deliverer has ever come lowly, humble. Jesus came lowly and riding upon an ass and upon the colt, the foal of an ass. And I will cut off the chariot from Ephraim and the horse from Jerusalem, and the battle bow shall be cut off, and he shall speak peace unto the heathen. This Messiah would speak peace unto the heathen. This is one of the reasons that some Jews rejected Jesus, because he was speaking peace to the heathen. He was not just for them. They wanted him just for themselves. And since he spoke peace to the heathen, even some still today will not accept him, because he wasn't their Messiah. He was offering deliverance to others, to the heathen. So he will speak peace unto the heathen. And his dominion shall be from sea even to sea, and from the river even to the ends of the earth. The idea of the river is the river Euphrates, which is where we believe that the source, the beginning of all life was there near the river Euphrates unto the ends of the earth. So his kingdom is from the beginning, from the oldest place where people have been to the furthest extent that anyone has ever gone. His kingdom covers all areas and all peoples. As for thee also, by the blood of thy covenant, I have sent forth thy prisoners out of the pit wherein is no water. Turn you to the stronghold, you prisoners of hope. Even today do I declare that I will render double unto thee. When I have bent Judah for me, filled the bowl with Ephraim, and raised up thy sons, O Zion, against thy sons, O Greece, and made thee as the sword of a mighty man. And Jehovah shall be seen over them, and his arrow shall go forth as the lightning. And as we continue to read, we're going to see this. These are more prophecies relating to the future rule and actions of the Messiah. Jehovah of hosts shall defend them, and they shall devour and subdue with sling stones. The sling stones were the first attackers in a line of in an army's line of attack. So they would, just the very first attack would subdue. And they shall drink and make noise as through wine, and they shall be filled like bowls and as the corners of the altar. And Jehovah their God shall save them in that day as the flock of his people. For they shall be as the stones of a crown lifted up as an ensign upon his land. For how great is his goodness and how great is his beauty. Corn shall make the young men cheerful, and new wine the maids. And here again I'm saying that there's a near and a far juxtaposition in these words. Ask ye of Jehovah rain in the time of the latter rain. So Jehovah shall make bright clouds and give them showers of rain to every one grass in the field. For the idols have spoken vanity, and the diviners have seen a lie and told false dreams. They comfort in vain, therefore they went their way as a flock. They were troubled because there was no shepherd. Mine anger was kindled against the shepherds, and I punished the goats. For Jehovah of hosts has visited his flock, the house of Judah, and has made them as his goodly horse in the battle. Out of him came forth the corner, out of him the nail, out of him the battle bow, out of him every oppressor together. And they shall be as mighty men which tread down their enemies in the mire of the streets in the battle. And they shall fight because Jehovah is with them, and the riders on horses shall be confounded. And I will strengthen the house of Judah, and I will save the house of Joseph, and I will bring them again to place for them. And this is a very encouraging phrase. For I have mercy upon them. I have mercy upon them. And since he has mercy upon them, or only since he has mercy upon them, only when we plead that mercy, they shall be as though I had not cast them off. For I am Jehovah their God, and will hear them. And they of Ephraim shall be like a mighty man, and their heart shall rejoice as through wine. Yea, their children shall see it and be glad. Their heart shall rejoice in Jehovah. I will hiss for them and gather them. For I have redeemed them, and they shall increase as they have increased. And I will sow them among the people, and they shall remember me in far countries, and they shall live with their children and turn again. I will bring them again also out of the land of Egypt and gather them out of Assyria, and I will bring them into the land of Gilead and Lebanon. And place shall not be found for them. And he shall pass through the sea with affliction, and shall smite the waves in the sea, and all the deeps of the river shall dry up, and the pride of Assyria shall be brought down, and the scepter of Egypt shall depart away. And I will strengthen them in Jehovah, and they shall walk up and down in his name. And then we have a prophecy of destruction. And it comes because of the rejection that they have. And it's kind of mixed together here, but I'll try to draw this out quickly as we read this list. It says, "Open thy doors, O Lebanon, that thy fire may devour thy cedars. The doors of the temple were made of cedar. Howl, fir tree, for the cedar is fallen, because thy mighty are spoiled. Howl, O ye oaks of Bashan, for the forest of the vintage is come down. There is a voice of howling of the shepherds, for their glory is spoiled, a voice of roaring of young lions, for the pride of Jordan is spoiled." When Rome destroyed Jerusalem, they destroyed the whole land. Trees for miles and miles and miles around were taken down and destroyed. I think that is some of what is being spoken of here. "Thus saith Jehovah my God, feed the flock of the slaughter, whose possessions slay them, and hold themselves not guilty. And they that sell them say, Blessed be Jehovah, for I am rich, and their own shepherds pity them not. For I will no more pity the inhabitants of the land, saith Jehovah, but lo, I will deliver the men, every one, into his neighbor's hand, and into the hand of his king, and they shall smite the land, and out of their hand I will not deliver them. And I will feed the flock of slaughter, even you, O poor of the flock." Now there's, he will feed the flock of slaughter. There's some poor of the flock that would be spared, and he would take care of them. "And I took unto me two staves, the one I called Beauty, and the other I called Bands, and I fed the flock. Three shepherds also I cut off in 1 month." It seems to be the elders, the priests, and the scribes that are referred to there. "And my soul loathed them, and their soul also abhorred me. Then I said, I will not feed you. That that dies, let it die. And that that is to be cut off, let it be cut off. And let the rest eat every one the flesh of another. And I took my staff, even Beauty, and cut it asunder, that I might break my covenant, which I had made with all the people. And it was broken in that day. And so the poor of the flock that waited upon me," there's always a remnant, "knew that it was the word of Jehovah. And I sent it to them, if you think good, give me my price." It's almost like, okay, they're in the marketplace, says, if you think this is good, give me, what's my price? Okay? "And if not, forbear. So they weighed for my price 30 pieces of silver. Leviticus, I believe it was, said that if a man had a slave and he was bored through and killed by an ox, the owner of the ox had to pay the owner of the slave 30 pieces of silver. So the Messiah is saying, give me my price, and they're saying, we think you're worth a dead slave. And they did that, 30 pieces of silver to Judas. If you think good, give me my price, and if not, forbear. So they weighed for my price 30 pieces of silver, and Jehovah said unto me, cast it unto the potter, a goodly price that I was prized out of them. And I took the 30 pieces of silver and cast them to the potter in the house of Jehovah. Then I cut asunder my other staff, even Bands, that I might break the brotherhood between Judah and Israel." The history tells us that when Rome was about to destroy, they were encamped around Jerusalem and about to destroy them, that inside Jerusalem they were fighting and at each other's necks like crazy. There was no brotherhood even inside the city. They were being attacked from the outside, and they were not united even inside the city. Jehovah said unto me, and this is tremendous judgment, I would say, tremendous in a different way than we might normally use it. "Jehovah said unto me, take unto thee yet the instruments of a foolish shepherd. For lo, I will raise up a shepherd in the land, which shall not visit those that be cut off, neither shall seek the young one, nor heal that that is broken, nor feed that that stands still." Okay, so this is not a very good shepherd, is it? That's judgment. "But he shall eat the flesh of the fat and tear their claws in pieces. Woe to the idle or vain shepherd that leaves the flock. The sword shall be upon his arm and upon his right eye. His arm shall be clean dried up, and his right eye shall be utterly darkened." So that's the end of this first burden, and then the second burden we'll look at next week, which is more focused toward the second end.